WBSM presents The Tim Meisberg Show, streaming live on WBSM.com and the WBSM app. Call 508-996-0500. Send us app chat messages and open line voicemails using the WBSM app. Now, The Tim Meisberg Show.
In third and final hour of the program here on Thursday morning, and I know we're not a sports station here, but after talking about where to find the Patriots game at the end of the last hour, now we're going to switch gears and talk about the Boston Celtics, because there's a great new book out that I think everybody will want to have on their shelf, on their coffee table, on their desk. And joining us now, we have Gary Washburn. He's the national NBA writer and columnist for the Boston Globe. He is also a parliamentarian of the National Association of Black Journalists Sports Task Force and is a two-time winner of the Salute to Excellence Award for his stories on the Boston Celtics. He also has a master's in journalism degree from the University of Nebraska, so he knows how to dig in and get those stories and find little gems that you might not have ever heard before. And he joins us on the line now. Good morning, Gary. How are you this morning?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing very well. And a longtime fan of your work. I used to cover the team with you when I worked for the Standard Times back in the days. And I want to say that this book, in looking through it, is probably my favorite compilation of some of these Celtic stories over the years, because the combination of the visuals with the story is really something that, to me, stands out as the definitive book on Celtics history.
Oh, well, yeah, thanks. It was a challenge, obviously, to try to whittle down 78 years of a franchise, especially with the history of the Celtics, into 175 moments. So, but it was fun to kind of go through and learn a lot about the franchise, especially, you know, before our times in the 50s and the 60s and some of our listeners in the 70s, where they don't remember, they only know these guys by names or maybe grainy pictures. It gives them kind of a vision of how this organization was built a long, long time ago, obviously 50, 60 years ago, and now has become obviously an 18-time champion, their most recent champion. So it was fun to find those moments, a great education for me, even though I knew a lot of the recent history and obviously the 80s and we, you know, Bird, McHale and Parrish, but to go a little further back was really, really helpful and educational.
Well, you're an LA guy. Did you grow up a Lakers fan?
Yes, I did. Huge.
So for you, you know, you had always heard these storied tales of the Boston Celtics, but I'm sure from your perspective growing up, it came from a different point of view, being on the other side of a lot of it.
Oh, totally. I mean, the Celtics were the enemies. They were the Lakers' biggest rival. You know, in growing up in the 80s, you only heard about, like, all the matchups in the 60s and how the Lakers were never able to beat the Celtics. And all those, you know, championship series with Jerry West and Elgin Baylor going crazy and scoring all the points, but then the Bill Russells and Tom Heinsohns and Sam Jones and Casey Jones just being overall the better team and winning those series, or the last one in 69 where Wilt Chamberlain was on the bench for the final 5 minutes because of a knee injury, and the Celtics go to the Forum in L.A. and steal Game 7 in Bill Russell's last game. I mean, what an amazing way to end your career on a championship with a team that wasn't favored to win. They kind of made an improbable run. So that's what I had heard. And then obviously their two matchups in the 1980s, sorry, three matchups, 84, 85, and 87, and just those epic games and just being so nervous, and especially when the Lakers would come to Boston and it was just a raucous atmosphere. It was always seemed like, even though it was June, it was always seemed like it was cold outside or something like that. It just seemed like it was them playing in Siberia or something when you're growing up and you see Boston. And now, obviously, living here, it's a little different.
Well, and you write about in the book too, you know, the kind of that second wave of that Celtics Lakers rivalry that came about in 2008 when you had the Kobe Lakers against the new big three Celtics. And that was a rivalry that went on for a couple of years and kind of extended that.
Yeah, meeting in the finals twice in 3 years, and it could have potentially been 3 years in a row if Kevin Garnett doesn't get hurt in 2009 and kind of derails the Celtics' chances of repeating. But yeah, that was kind of the new Jack, you know, the new fans were kind of introduced to the rivalry, you know, because you hear about it, but they had not played in the finals since 1987. Both teams kind of went through some down times, especially the Celtics, you know. In the book, I touch on the 90s, and it was a lot of hard times, you know, starting with like the loss of Lynn Bias and then Reggie Lewis, and then a lot of coaching changes and the Rick Pitino failure and them trying to gasp to get back to greatness, and it never quite worked. But then Danny Ainge, you know, brings on Kevin Garnett and Ray Allen to join Paul Pierce, and suddenly they're back on that championship stage against Kobe. And he had something to prove because Shaq was gone and he wanted to prove he could win a title on his own. So two really epic matchups in 3 years. And I touch on the one in 08, obviously, which was a victorious one for the Celtics. And then the one in 2010 where the Celtics kind of wasted an opportunity to win another title and lost in game seven.
Yeah, and when you have a franchise as storied as the Celtics with so much success, it's easy to put out a book that just hits the greatest hits over the years. But like you said, you talk about the 90s, and you're critical of the way that things were handled in some of these entries, including, you know, there's one on the giving up on Chauncey Billups. So you don't have any problem calling out where there were, you know, mistakes made over the years. There haven't been a lot, but there certainly have been some that have had an impact on the franchise.
Yeah, just some things, you know, basically after Bert, you know, like they won the title in 86, and then the team progressively got older. Bert, you know, was dealing with injuries, and so was McHale, and Parrish was getting older. And then kind of the early 90s where they all kind of departed or they got older, and then the Celtics made so many attempts to try to just get back into the game. And obviously, as you, I'm sure, remember, it was the Chicago Bulls time. That was Michael Jordan's era. And the Celtics just couldn't compete in that area. And they started to build in the late 90s with drafting Paul Pierce, even, you know, drafting Antoine Walker. But then, you know, they tried to, you know, get the Rick Pitino thing, I think, is something to touch on, because that was just, it was some painful times. But they were just starting. They just started to get back into some significance in the early 2000s, making the Eastern Conference Finals in 2002, and then another downtimes, and then obviously bringing on Danny Ainge, who then hires Doc Rivers, and then the bringing on of Garnett and Allen. So, you touch on, you know, as much as, you know, you could touch on only the good times and only the championships, that period from 1986 to 2008 was tough on Celtic fans.
And with a franchise that has had so many marquee players over the years, or names that become, you know, emblazoned in New England history, if not in NBA history, you've also dove into some of the role players who, you know, if you go back to Red Auerbach's philosophy of basketball, you know, those role players are just as important as the starters. And you talk about a lot of those role players over the years that have made a difference.
Yeah, I mean, guys like Frank Ramsey, Jim Luskatoff, Paul Silas, Charlie Scott, guys who contributed, Don Nelson. You know, we all look at the rafters of the Celtics and all the retired numbers, and a lot of us don't know a lot of those guys who wore those numbers. We just know that they're retired. You know, guys like Ed McCauley, you know, they're just, even Dave Cowens, as much as he's an all-time great Celtic and a Hall of Famer, not a lot's known about Dave and his time there. And JoJo White, guys who, you know, before the NBA was a major sport, when he was far behind the NFL and Major League Baseball in the early 1970s and late 1960s, where it was kind of the third sport and had maybe one game on per week. These guys were all-time greats. And so I try to touch on some of the guys, even, you know, the more recent, you know, Kendrick Perkins and guys who contributed to a title, who might not have Dennis Johnson, who might not have the big name, or people might not remember as fondly as Larry Bird or, you know, Bill Russell or Bob Cousy, but still, you know, Sam Jones, Casey Jones, but still contributed to championships.
And the book isn't just about the players and the teams and the ball that was played on court either. It really gives you an idea of the philosophy of the team and of the organization as a whole. So just for an example, you know, the Landon Turner story is a great one that a lot of Celtics fans don't remember. It's one of those things that when it comes up, people say, oh, yeah, but it's a story that deserves to be told over and over again because it shows that the Celtics were more than just about the product on the court. They were about, you know, what they represented in the world of sports.
Yeah, I mean, I just think the impact of Red Auerbach, obviously, he's a guy who knew so many people and obviously kind of collaborating with Bobby Knight to draft. Landon Turner was a player at the University of Indiana who was headed to his senior year and got in a car accident and was paralyzed and obviously, you know, ending his NBA chances. And the Celtics took him back when the draft was 12 rounds, took him with the last pick of the last round. So he became a Celtics draft pick. And, you know, Red sent him a championship watch, you know, when they won the titles in 84 and 86 to kind of just keep him involved in the organization, even though obviously he was never going to play. And there were just so many stories. I mean, one I didn't mention is, you know, Red used to do kind of a television show in terms of during NBA games at halftime, he would get a current NBA player and he would work on or have that player show the fans a nifty move or a move to work with young kids. Like that would never happen. Could you imagine, you know, a current NBA coach and a player during halftime of a game working on a move together? And that was Red. Red would, with his cigar, would go on the court and get Pete Maravich or George Gervin or one of Julius Erving and they would work on things and they would show that at halftime of games. So Red was just, I mean, obviously an innovator, one of the more impactful players ever in the history of the NBA. Not players, but executives.
And it's one of those situations too where people who are Celtics are Celtics for life. Even if they, you know, go and play with other teams, they always, I mean, just look at a guy like Bill Walton who would just, you know, heap praise on Red Auerbach and the Celtics. But I remember back when Ricky Davis was a contender for Sixth Man of the Year and I was doing a feature on him and I called on a whim. I called the bank that Frank Ramsey worked at. And I, you know, said, if he can call me back, and he not only called me back, he gave me an hour and a half on the phone, just reflecting back on being a Sixth Man, talking about Ricky Davis's game. He knew all the ins and outs of what was going on with the team. People who were Celtics for life, and Celtics fans have been Celtics fans for life.
Yeah, I mean, that's the great thing of being on the other side, obviously, coming here and covering this team, you just find out about the tradition and all the players that come back. And, you know, a guy I got to know pretty well during stories was John, before he passed, was John Havlicek. And obviously, a personal story, like I wrote in the book about Havlicek retiring in 1978, and his last official, like, on-court appearance, I was there. He played an exhibition game, kind of a charity game at the Inglewood Forum about maybe 2 months after he retired. And I had a T-shirt that obviously I wore out that said I saw Hondo's last game. And so I always remembered that. I think I might have told him that story, and he might have laughed at the story. But just getting to know guys like him and, you know, even talking to the great, like Walton and Paul, guys have now since unfortunately passed, and Casey Jones and some of those guys over the years coming back to Boston, and Bill Russell, obviously. I know Bob Cousy's still alive and kicking, and even forming a good friendship during my time here with Cedric Maxwell, a guy who obviously is very popular in the Lakers-Celtics series for some of his trash talk and his obviously contributions on the floor. That's the thing about this organization is the great tradition and how they honor those guys and bring them back. It's kind of once a Celtic, always a Celtic. And Boston's a city that appreciates winners and appreciates guys that contributed to championship teams. You know, you can go look at the Red Sox, and, you know, when Dave Roberts comes back with the Dodgers, he gets a big standing O because he stole that key base and that, you know, comeback from the 3-0 deficit, you know, and he sparked that rally, and he'll always be remembered, although he maybe spent one or two seasons with the Red Sox. So, you know, Boston remembers its all-time greats, but it also remembers those players that contributed to championships.
And speaking of championships, that leads to a question I want to ask you. So obviously this is a book that took a lot of time to put together. And so is there a thought, you know, was there the possibility that this book was going to be done before the Celtics won the title? And is there a thought like, let's hang on, because we might have a really great final chapter for this book if the Celtics end up winning, you know, banner 18 here?
Yeah, that's a great question. Like last year we were working on it, and obviously they fell short. They lost in the Eastern Conference Finals, game 7. So we decided to hold off. And so regardless of what happened this past year, the book was going to be released. But obviously it worked out much better with kind of being tapped championship edition when they won the title. So that really kind of added the whipped cream and the frosting to the book, because, you know, you want to end this thing and have the history on a positive note. You don't want to have to, you know, unfortunately talk about, let's say, a tough loss in the playoffs or falling short once again. And in 23, it was a really disappointing ending for him. Jason Tatum sprained his ankle in game 7. They fall short of coming back from a 3-0 deficit. But this year was just something different. And it was kind of like, okay, this looks like these guys might be capable of getting to the back to the mountaintop. So it kind of ended perfectly for them.
So now I'm going to ask you a compound question here. I want to ask you what you think their chances are this year, and also where you see this issue with Celtics ownership going.
Well, I think they have a really good chance of repeating it. I'm not going to say, you know, 70-30, but I'd say, you know, for any team to come back, it's going to be hard. It's going to be a harder season than last year, because now they're everybody's Super Bowl. Everyone's going to be coming at them. Teams have already ramped up, like the Knicks and the Sixers and other teams, the Oklahoma City Thunder, specifically to face the Celtics and to beat the Celtics. So this will be a difficult season, a more difficult season than last year, because now they were chasing. This year they're going to be the pursued, and that's going to be hard. But I do think they have a good chance. I think they have the mental capacity to do it in terms of the disposition, taking the season seriously, staying healthy. That's very key too. And I know Kristaps Porzingis will be out for the first few months. And so I think that might be eventually a good thing for the Celtics, because in the playoffs he'll be a little bit healthier and fresher because he'll have less games on his legs. So I'm sure they'll take their time bringing him back. The ownership situation is going to be interesting, because I think, one, the NBA is going to definitely observe this. They want to know how much the Celtics are going to cost. And I think it could be in the neighborhood of $6 billion, billion with a B, and which would be the most expensive price ever paid for an NBA team. And they're going to, you know, is it a group of people? Is it just one rich guy or gal who's going to come along and just scoop them up? And then is that owner, and I think that's a kind of a question for a lot of people, basketball, non-basketball, I think a new owner is going to want to build a new arena. And because the Celtics do not own the arena, and where the money is made in team ownership is owning the arena. So now I think that you're going to have to, and maybe discussions are going to talk about, where would you build a new Celtics arena? And is Boston, the city of Boston, ready for a new state-of-the-art venue? You know, TD Garden, it's in the book. You know, TD Garden will be 30 years old in 2025. It's a nice arena, but obviously there's new arenas opening up every year. It's not the state-of-the-art arena that others are. Is Boston ready for a state-of-the-art sports arena, an arena to host concerts and that type of thing, where the Celtics would play? And where would you put that arena? That's another question. Is there land? Would you put it near the casino on Encore? Would you put it on the seaport? Like, where would you put such arena? So those are things that have to be discussed in terms of a new owner, because I think any new owner will want to build a new arena.
And if any owner is coming in from out of town, if they're not, you know, New England people, the first thing we should do is we should mail them a copy of the Boston Celtics, an illustrated timeline, so they can get all caught up on Celtics history. Gary, I want to thank you for joining us. We look forward to reading all your coverage this year in the Boston Globe. And I know you've got some book signings coming up where people can come out and meet you and they can get a copy of the book signed. We have in Connecticut coming up on Saturday, September 28th at the WBUR City Space in Boston on Monday, September 30th. In Hingham at the Barnes & Noble on Saturday, October 5th. And probably the most local one to our audience is Sunday, October 20th at the Barnes & Noble in East Walpole. So people can come on out. They can get the book anywhere, though, right? It's available in all the bookstores and on Amazon.
Yes, sir. Target, Amazon, even eBay, if you do a search there. So, yeah, definitely thank you. Thank you for having me. And, yeah, hopefully Celtic fans will get something definitely education out of the book.
All right. Thank you so much for joining us and have a great season this year.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. That is Gary Washburn, the Celtics writer and NBA writer for the Boston Globe and the author of The Boston Celtics, an Illustrated Timeline. I've got to take a break here. We'll be back in just a few moments. All right. Well, we can take some of your calls coming up at 508-996-0500. App chat is still open on the WBSM app as well. Got to take a dive into the newsroom, though, right now and get all the top stories of the day from our own sixth man, Phil Devitt.
Former President Trump says New York will help him back to the White House. The CDC says a drop in vaccinations has consequences. And what's being added to the Toy Hall of Fame?
From the WBSM Newsroom, this is WBSM News.
Former President Trump says the state of New York will vote with him in November.
It hasn't been done for a long time. But we are going to win New York.
Security was tight at the rally in Uniondale on Wednesday, the first since an apparent assassination attempt in Florida. New York officials said earlier reports about explosives being found near the site were false. The state has voted for Democrats in the last 9 elections. Trump also said during the rally he felt God saved his life so he can make America great again. The Teamsters Union is breaking with tradition and will not endorse a candidate for president this year. Trump reacted to Wednesday's news.
Teamsters carry a lot of weight. The Democrats cannot believe that. And, you know, look, this is it was always automatic that Democrats get the Teamsters. And they said we won't endorse the Democrats this year. So that was an honor for me.
The West Coast Teamsters are breaking with the national chapter and are endorsing Kamala Harris for president. Sean Diddy Combs will remain detained until he goes on trial for sex trafficking and racketeering charges. The hip-hop and business mogul was back in federal court in Manhattan on Wednesday to appeal Tuesday's decision that he be held without bail. Federal officials are warning that a drop in vaccinations in the U.S. may have led to an increase in flu deaths among children. Temi Trujillo reports.
The CDC said Wednesday that nearly 200 children died from influenza-related illnesses during the most recent flu season, and that most of the children who died were eligible for a vaccine but didn't receive one. It said the deaths coincide with overall drops in vaccinations among children. As of May, the CDC said only 53% of children in the U.S. were vaccinated for the flu this season. That's down from the previous year. I'm Tammy Trujillo.
European astronomers say Elon Musk's Starlink satellites are blocking their view of the universe. Michael Kastner with the details on that.
Researchers at the Netherlands Institute for Radio Astronomy told BBC News on Wednesday that the new generation of Starlink satellites are interfering more with radio telescopes than earlier versions of the satellite. They say radio waves from thousands of orbiting satellites are blinding radio telescopes and possibly hindering astronomical research. Starlink satellites provide broadband internet to remote places around the world. I'm Michael Kastner.
A new survey shows a lot of remote workers doing household chores while on the job. SurveyMonkey polled over 3,000 full-time workers in the U.S. last month and found that nearly half of those who work from home are doing laundry and other items on their to-do list. About one-third say they run errands while remote working. And the 12 finalists have been announced for this year's induction into the Toy Hall of Fame. Each year, the Strong National Museum of Play in Rochester, New York, nominates 12 toys that have achieved icon status, three of which will be inducted into the Hall of Fame. This year's finalists include Transformers, Pokemon trading cards, balloons, trampolines, and My Little Pony.
WBSM Sports.
Red Sox beat the Tampa Bay Rays last night 2-1, wrapping the series tonight at 6:50 in Florida. And the New England Patriots on the road visiting the New York Jets tonight for the third game of the season. That starts at 8:15. We'll carry the game for you right here on WBSM.
Now, your ABC 6 South Coast forecast.
Gray skies and patchy fog this morning with temperature in the mid-60s. Occasional rain as we head into the afternoon. That chance for showers will prevail. Temperature in the low 70s with the wind picking up out of the northeast. Chance of showers will continue overnight with some patchy fog. And then as we head into Friday, wrapping up this work week with high possibility for showers to continue. Temperature in the upper 60s and breezy. Be sure to watch ABC 6 for my full 7-day forecast. From the ABC 6 Weather Center, I'm meteorologist Ceci del Carmen on New Bedford's News Talk Station 1420 WBSM.
Weather on WBSM is brought to you by SeaStreak. Whether it's a daycation or a staycation, get there with SeaStreak. Visit SeaStreak.com for reservations to Martha's Vineyard or Nantucket. I'm Phil Devitt for WBSM News. Stay up to date with New Bedford's News Talk Station WBSM and get all of our content and breaking news alerts with the WBSM app.
Again, it's falling down, so bring an umbrella with you if you're heading out. Let's go back to the phones, 508-996-0500. Good morning. You are next on WBSM.
Morning, Tim.
How's it going?
Not bad. I got a lot to talk about. I'm trying to crunch it in for you.
Sure.
So a lot of people say that there are, and a lot of politicians say that there are, certain things that the government can do that are basic human rights. One of them, usually it always comes from, the progressive side. For instance, healthcare is a human right. That's something that Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, they all say healthcare is a human right. But a human right cannot be taken away or given by the government, but yet that's what they are proposing. So this is where I would disagree with them saying that is a right. It is the right of any American to have health care. It's not a right. The same thing, it's not a right for housing, and it's not a right for food. Any time that the government can give you that, they propose that the government gives you, they say that's a human right, but yet rights are not distributed by the government.
Well, I think there's a difference between giving it to you and facilitating it for you.
Well, I mean, when you're proposing a single-payer healthcare system, that's giving it. Because now it's literally taking taxes from everyone and then offering it to you for no additional cost. So that is literally giving it to you.
But, I mean, do you have to take it?
Yes. Absolutely, yes, you have to take it. Just like you have to take Medicare. You cannot refuse it. You have to sign
but
up.
It is
a mandate.
If you just put in that provision, if they can work, which a lot of people have asked for. A lot of people want that. They want to be able to have that control. If you get that, then you can say, well, then it becomes them facilitating it, not them granting it.
Well, I would have to say that if they're taking taxes out anyway, you might as well take it, right? Now, because taxes are involuntary.
Right.
Right? Then you have to take it because your representative has made you take it. You send a representative to Congress to tax you. Or not to tax you. And they said, we're going to tax you. So they're going to take the money out of your check. So you might as well take it. Or you're just literally giving money away.
But I also think it's one of those situations, first of all, that everybody who is opposed to it, if they had it, they wouldn't be opposed to it. I think if they had it and it worked the way that it's envisioned is working, which will take some trial and error for sure. But once it's happening and people say, why wouldn't we do this all the time? Why we'd wait so long to do this? The problem is there's just so many flawed ways of getting there that that people are reluctant to do it. But I if you look at other countries that are able to provide it, yeah, they went through their growing pains for it. But universally, there's nobody in those countries, at least as far as I know, who are opposed to it anymore.
Oh, there are plenty of countries that are opposed to it. But just like
people within the countries that have it.
No, that's what I'm saying. Like, if you look at Canada, it's not 100%. Canada is not 100% in favor. Like if you were to poll people, they would prefer a private healthcare system where they can choose a doctor, and doctors themselves are in the UK, not in Canada, but doctors themselves in the UK are government employees. That you don't want that. The hospitals are government run and owned by the government, and doctors and nurses are government employees, where in Canada it's private, but everything's paid for via taxes.
I would assume they say that with the implication of, I also want to pay the same thing that I'm paying now for it if it is privatized.
I don't know. It depends on if the quality of care, because there's a lot of people that say that the quality of care is not as good as anywhere else. But we're digressing from my original point, which is a right. It's not a right. Right. It's not whether or not it's good or bad. That's a long debate and we can have. But when Elizabeth Warren or anybody else comes out and says health insurance is a human right, they're wrong.
Well, I think the way they get around that, though, the way they get around that is they say access to it is a right.
Access to it is a right. Okay.
I think that, I get your point, but I think that that's the language that they use to get around that.
Yeah, I mean, I could see that. I could see that. But the other point I wanted to make is in regards to Donald Trump and the Teamsters. I think that is historical that they're not going to endorse Harris. And do you know in 2020 or in 2016, the internal poll of the Teamsters and how they felt in regards to Donald Trump?
I do not.
Because right now they're coming out and it's like 60-40, 70-30 in favor of Trump for rank and file union members. Now, I was a union member for decades. And when I initially got in, you know, I listened to the union business manager and said, this is why we're supporting them. This is why we're supporting Obama. And this is why we're supporting whoever. And I listened to him and I was like, all right, so they're in favor of this, that, and the other thing that we're also in favor of. I'll vote for that. But the fact that the Teamsters are the like rank and file guys are coming out and they're saying absolutely not with Harris. And the fact that I think what really hurt the Democratic ticket is they didn't invite the president of the Teamsters to the convention. They snubbed them as if they're taking the support of the union for granted. And I think this could be a big turning point for a lot of the unions. If the Teamsters can steer the union movement away from Democrats, Democrats are done. Because all the Democrats have, other than the unions, are your social justice people, people who are running on transgender rights or gay rights and very niche issues that a lot of people aren't really gravitated toward.
Now, one thing, just to make clear, because people might get confused in their minds and say, well, if the Teamsters aren't endorsing them, that shows that, you know, they don't have any confidence in either candidate. So when a union endorses a candidate, they're not endorsing a candidate because they think that they're the best person for America. They're endorsing a candidate because they think it's the best person for the union. And the reason why they're not endorsing either candidate is because they couldn't secure the pledges that they wanted for their union from those candidates. So this isn't about whether or not they support the candidate personally or whether or not they're going to vote for them personally. This is about whether or not, as an organization, they're going to support them. And in reality, this is why I think endorsements don't really matter to the average voter, because the issues that the Teamsters have, the common voter doesn't care about.
I would have to disagree. The issue that the Teamsters have is good pay for and safety for the trucking industry, right? You would have to say that, you know, whether or not they have to work in a truck that's over 100 degrees.
And I don't deny there's an impact and effect on the entire economy from that. I'm just saying, like, to the average voter, they're hearing that and they're like, yeah, no, that doesn't apply to me because I'm not part of that union.
Oh, 1,000%. Now, but it does affect the million or so Teamster employees, right? The Teamster members, it does affect, and their extended family. So if I'm a Teamster and I work for whatever company, I also have a wife and maybe a couple kids that are of voting age. So now I am not voting for the Democrat. Now my wife is probably also going to follow suit, and my two kids, and maybe my brother. So now, because it's, say, a million voters that are a million members, it becomes 4 million people who are not voting, because it's an extension of the initial member. Obviously, your extended family, and maybe even your friends. You know, your very close-knit friends that know that you pay attention and you can influence them. Mm-hmm. So it does affect, it doesn't affect you and me, who don't really care. I don't, like I said, I don't care if the if the Teamsters picked Trump or Waltz. It doesn't affect my personal decision, but it does affect the members. And that's why endorsements are important, because if in the beginning of our conversation, if you remember, my decision was based on what my business manager would tell me. Because this is why we're supporting him, or this is why we're supporting her, because these are the issues that we care about and we're fighting for, and they said that they're going to support it. So this is why you should vote for him. And I'd be like, oh, all right, you know, that makes sense. And that's how a lot of people are in the union.
Yeah. I got to hold you there, though, because I got some other calls I got to get in. But thank you for the call. Have a good day.
You got it. You too.
And let's take one more before I got to take a break. Good morning. You're next on WBSM.
Good morning, Mr. Weisberg. Good
morning.
When I was coming home yesterday, coming down Purchase Street, I saw the brand new sign that they put up. Now, I don't know when they put it up. I go by there all the time, but I didn't see it until yesterday, which doesn't mean it was just put there. I could have missed it. But first time I saw it yesterday, it's on the corner of Purchase and Logan Street. And it's a big sign with a nice shiny arrow pointing down Logan, and it says commuter rail with that big arrow. Mm-hmm. Now, if you're going to go down Logan from Purchase, you see that sign, you're going to go down Logan. There's only two streets that you can turn. You can turn right on the avenue, which is the first street you come to, right where the Wamsutter apartments are. Or you can pass that street and go straight down to North Front Street. Now, I haven't looked yet. So which street would a person take if they're going down Logan because they see commuter rail and you get down to that corner? So are you going to go all the way down North Front Street, or are you going to turn right on the avenue? Because I think you can get to the train from there. I can see the train from my window when it comes by. It's been practice run all the time.
I was just down there on Friday, kind of driving around, taking a look at the area. And I didn't see that sign, so it must be new.
From Purchase. Yeah, it looked new to me because I would have noticed it. And I only saw it yesterday, nice and shiny and new.
It was reported on Channel 12, and I think Phil might have mentioned it too, that you're going to start to see more signs now popping up for the commuter rail. But I think I don't know all the streets when you get over into that area, but I know that the entrance into the parking lot is across from, you know, like all the warehouses and businesses on the waterfront there.
Yeah.
So
I'm going to go that way when I go out later, because all I saw was that arrow pointing down Logan, and I said to myself, because I know the area, if you're going to go down Logan, the first corner you're going to come to is the Cushion Avenue, and you can turn right, because if you're going to turn left, you're still going to end up taking another right because you're blocked by Route 18 in that corner. So you're going to go down a Cushion Avenue, and the last one, if you go straight down, you'll hit North Front Street, where Revere Copper and all that used to be. So I'm going to go look today when I go out there to find out where that's going. And one more thing. I heard that a guy that called in, I didn't hear everything you were saying, but I guess it was negative about the moderators or something.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking, why don't you moderators all get together and say to each other, look, if somebody calls your show and talks about me, let them talk so I can hear what they're saying about me and see what this is about, and then I'll reply later. I want to hear what they're saying. So why can't you all agree on that?
Because we don't want that.
Somebody,
we all agree that we don't want that. Because
how bad could it be?
Because
you don't want to know if somebody's talking about you?
No. Well, first of all, I don't care. But secondly, why should somebody else's show be filled up with that? They spend all those hours preparing for their show so that they can get a complaint session about somebody else, something they didn't even hear probably.
Well, what do you mean filled up? I don't think you're going to get a lot of callers calling in and doing that.
One turns into another, and it takes you off topic. No, everybody works hard to plan what they're doing. They don't need to spend time talking about me or me talking about them.
You just
like it when people fight, Mary. That's all.
Well, listen. I could call all the other shows and say a lot about you, but I'd rather say it to you, and I do it that way. But the other guys, they tell you, instead of calling the right person, they call anybody.
All right. Well.
Oh, the only reason I didn't take a picture of that new sign with the arrow was because I was flying by. But when I go by there today, I'll stop and take a picture.
All right. Well, you have a good day. Right. Stay dry out there
you
in the rain.
Too.
All right. I got to take a break here. We'll be back. We'll try to squeeze in some more calls. We will be back in just a few moments.
Hi.
And you know, we... All right, have a
WBSM and W258DR, New Bedford, a Town Square Media Station.